10% off the manufacturer's suggested retail price, and some items will be discounted more than 40%. Get your home all ready for the upcoming holidays. Do you have a comfy, cozy recliner or sofa all ready and waiting for you by the fire this winter? No? Well, Novello Furniture's well stocked with recliners for sale during their annual November sale. Novello's biggest sale of the year. This is a once-a-year sale for Novello's loyal customers, and everything will be at about 40% off. Bedroom sets, sofas, dining room sets, mattresses, armchairs, leather sofas, sectionals, and more. Now is the time to get beautiful furniture for a fabulous price. Novello is overstocked with affordable furniture, and now it's about 40% off. Novello has free local delivery and offers financing to qualified buyers. Novello Furniture on the Barry Montpelier Road. Better furniture for less.
Hurry! Sale ends November 10th.
It's time to get the story behind the story. Interviews with newsmakers, newsbreakers, and your phone calls. Radio Vermont presents The Mark Johnson Show.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the program. Thanks for tuning in day after the election. Thanks for spending part of your morning with us. I anticipate we'll have a lively discussion this morning. Love to hear from you. You can reach us at 244-1777. That's our local number in Central Vermont. And you can also reach us on our toll-free lines at 877-291-8255. Well, the election that wasn't supposed to be all that exciting, according to the pundit class, including me. Boy, a lot of crow getting eaten this morning. What a night last night. Republican Scott Mellon really giving Democratic incumbent Peter Shumlin quite the challenge here. The latest numbers we have this morning, 88,500 votes for Shumlin, 86,000 roughly for Scott Mellon, about a 46.5% to 45%. So, no one predicted this was going to happen, and quite a surprise this morning. We're going to bring in our political analyst, Eric Davis, to join us live on the line. And again, we'd welcome your phone calls at 244-1777, toll-free 877-291-8255. Professor, good morning.
Good morning, Mark.
How did we all miss the depth of this dissatisfaction with Peter Shumlin?
Well, last Friday when I was on your show, I said I thought the lowest Shumlin would do was 48, and the highest Mellon would do was 42. And Shumlin didn't make 48, and Mellon did better than 42. So it was obviously a lot closer than you and I thought it would. There was that poll that the Castleton Institute did about a month ago now, and they showed Shumlin's approval rating at, I believe the numbers were 48 for, 45 against, and that's about the margin by which he was reelected. So I think in many ways this election turned into a referendum on Peter Shumlin. A lot of voters, for whatever reason, have reservations about him, do not support him continuing as governor. And Scott Mellon, in spite of the fact that he got into the campaign late and did not have a very well-organized or well-funded campaign, ended up coming a lot closer than any of us anticipated.
But how did we all miss this?
I think we thought that Shumlin's advantages in terms of organization and money over Mellon were going to let him, if not cruise to victory, have a relatively comfortable victory. A couple of other points I'd make, Mark, is that Dan Feliciano, the Libertarian, seems to have got between 6,000 and 7,000 votes. In other words, Feliciano got more than twice as many votes as the margin between Shumlin and Mellon. And one wonders if Feliciano had not been on the ballot, might Mellon have even been able to defeat Shumlin?
Mm-hmm. Do you think the opposition to Shumlin is more political or personal?
It's both. It's both. I mean, he's never had the strong degree of personal support that other politicians have had. I think on the issues, there's a concern about a number of issues. Health care is obviously one of them. Both the performance of Vermont Health Connect or the non-performance of that website to date, as well as the plans for single payer. I think there's some people concerned about his record on environmental issues. I did notice it was interesting that in some of the towns in the Northeast Kingdom and in Addison County, where there are wind and gas pipeline projects in the works, Shumlin's support dropped more than his statewide support did. The national exit polls show that voters are very dissatisfied with the state of the economy. Those polls weren't administered in Vermont, but I suspect if they had been, they would have shown the same sort of thing.
What areas of the state did you see that Shumlin did poorly in that
yeah,
he'd done well before?
I looked at the results by town, and it seems to me that Shumlin came in first because he ran up big majorities in the core of Chittenden County, Burlington, South Burlington, and Winooski, in the city of Montpelier, and in southern Vermont, Windsor, Windham, and Bennington counties. Milne ended up winning many of the Chittenden County suburbs. Milne won Colchester, he won Essex, he won Williston, he won Westford, for example. Many of the smaller towns in Orange County, Addison County, Lamoille County, Washington County, so the middle part of the state, where Shumlin won with maybe 50 to 55% of the vote 2 years ago, Milne won those towns this time around. So Shumlin was really, what I find interesting is that Shumlin really had to rely on the core of Chittenden County, Montpelier, and his former home territory in southern Vermont in order to pull out a very narrow first place finish.
How do you explain him losing the suburbs in Chittenden County?
I think, you know, again, I'm not so sure it was that it was the organization of the Milne campaign, although the Republicans did pick up a few legislative seats in that territory, too. I think in places like Williston and Essex and Colchester, in part it's a concern about property taxes. I think in part it's a concern about the economy, you know, what's going to happen with IBM changing ownership and that sort of thing. And a sense among voters, not just in the Chittenden suburbs, but across much of the state, perhaps, that one-party Democratic control has gone a bit too far in Montpelier and that the pendulum needs to swing at least a little bit back in the other direction. As the Republicans would put it in their press releases, it's time for a change.
We're talking with political analyst Eric Davis. You know, there's a lot of speculation that if somebody like Randy Brock or somebody else, a better organized, better known candidate, had run for the Republicans, that that person would have won. But on the other hand, you know, is there something to what Scott Milne did here where you run basically a blank slate campaign?
Well, there's something to that. But again, I think, you know, the disadvantage Scott Milne had is that he got started late. He only declared on the filing deadline. He really didn't have a good supporting cast in terms of political advisors and policy advisors on his staff, and he didn't have much money. You know, I wonder, again, if the Republicans can come up with a consensus candidate for the next time, by December of 2015, if the Republicans can come up with a consensus candidate and that person can raise a good deal of money, between now and the summer of 2016, might a Republican candidate be able to either to beat Shumlin or, if he chooses not to run for re-election, win an open seat governor's race in 2 years?
Mm-hmm. And I mean, who's that going to be other than, I mean, does Scott Milne have a claim here on that?
I don't know if it's Scott Milne. I think the big question in terms of the political futures mark at this point is, A, will Shumlin run for re-election?
Right.
B, what will Phil Scott do in 2 years? And will there be pressure from the Republican Party on Phil Scott to announce a candidacy for governor regardless of what Shumlin declares?
Right. Boy, I mean, it seems like for Phil Scott, there's certainly blood in the water, huh?
Yeah, I mean, Phil Scott got over 60% of the vote, did much better against Dean Corin, again, than a lot of us thought. And, you know, if Phil Scott can get the Republican Party unified behind him, which is going to be a challenge, I think he could be very competitive against Shumlin in 2 years, or he could be a strong contender for an open seat race.
How damaged is Shumlin politically? I mean, we're sitting here today, the day after. I mean, this is probably,
I mean, he'll get reelected by the legislature in January, but he's in a much weakened political position. First of all, over the next 2 years, he's going to have to spend a lot more time in Vermont than he did in the last two. You know, Milne kept talking about the number of days he spent out of state. Much of that was due to the DGA. And Shumlin's performance as chair of the DGA was not particularly good either. The Democrats picked up a formerly Republican gubernatorial seat in Pennsylvania, but they lost the governorships in several blue states. They lost Illinois, they lost Massachusetts, and they lost Maryland. Plus the governors that the DGA had targeted, the Republican governors DGA had targeted in Florida and Michigan and Kansas and Maine, all won re-election. So it wasn't a good day for Shumlin as chair of DGA either. He's going to have to, I think, over the next 2 years, focus on addressing some of the concerns that to me seem to be evident in these results. One is fixing Vermont Healthcare Connect, really making sure that it works, both the website and all the other things associated with it. Second, working through some of the issues in the Agency of Human Services, getting new management into that agency and dealing with some of the issues in the Department of Children and Families that have come up in the last couple of years. Third, I think a big issue has to be addressing property taxes, education, finance, education, governance. And Speaker Shep Smith appears to be working on that one already. And finally, with the Republicans now winning control of the U.S. Senate, it's quite possible that federal funding to state governments will be reduced over the next 2 years. Vermont depends a lot on federal funds for both the highway and health care programs, so getting the state budget in order is going to be a big challenge, too. So that's a big agenda. Notice I haven't mentioned single-payer health care.
Mm-hmm. What do you think this does for single-payer health care?
I think the chances of a single-payer financing plan passing in the next 2 years are much less now than they were before the election. You know, someone will probably announce it sometime after the legislature comes back. But with the Republicans gaining seats in both chambers, especially in the Senate, I'm not sure a single-payer plan could be approved. In the Senate, Republicans picked up two, so it's 21-9. But the Democratic caucus in the Senate includes a wide range of views, and people like Dick Sears, Dick Mazza, John Rogers, Alice Nitka, Brian Campion, the new senator from Bennington County, those people may not be great enthusiasts for single payer, and if it ends up being a tie vote, Phil Scott would break the tie against. So I think the prospects for single payer are a lot lower today than they were before the election.
Is Peter Shumlin done politically?
I'm not sure, Mark. I think I told you, I mentioned this in one of our conversations earlier this fall. The first chapter of Jim Douglas's recent memoir, Douglas says one reason he decided to leave after four terms is that it's often been said every governor stays one term too long, and Jim Douglas didn't want that said about him. And, you know, Shumlin fell by 10 percentage points from 2012 to 2014, and he doesn't have room to fall anymore. So the question for me is you know, can he rehabilitate himself and win in 2016, which will be a presidential year? Perhaps the turnout be higher, more Democrats voting. Or does he decide to call it a career and not run for re-election as governor? Or the other open question is, what does Pat Leahy do following the Republican takeover of the U.S. Senate? Does he retire or does he run for re-election? And if there's an open Senate seat, how might that shake up Vermont politics? And Shumlin would be part of that discussion, too.
All right, but what claim at this point now, having almost lost to Scott Milne, would Peter Shumlin have to run for that office?
Actually, I think he might be a stronger candidate for the U.S. Senate than governor because, first of all, senators don't have to administer any programs. They're not responsible for overseeing a bureaucracy and managing, and I think that's a sense where Shumlin has not done as well as many people hoped. Second, it's national issues rather than state issues, and even though the Republicans gained statewide, there's a long way to go before the Republicans are going to win U.S. Senate or presidential elections in Vermont. We saw Peter Welch won comfortably re-election with 60% or somewhat more. So you know, if there is an open Senate seat, I wouldn't be surprised if Shumlin would at least think about it.
Do the results validate the way Scott Milne ran the campaign?
I think Scott Milne's focus on Shumlin's negatives is one of the things that drew Shumlin down, talking about him spending a lot of time campaigning out of state for the DGA, the problems with Vermont Health Connect, calling single-payer reckless and unproven and radical and those various things. I think all of that did make a difference.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a call from Barry. Bill, good morning.
Good morning. Hang on a second. Let me turn the radio off. I've got a take on Scott Milne. I really, really have learned to like him very much, and I don't think any of the other people that you mentioned. I like Randy Brock, but I think Scott Milne is the one that did this. I first met him. First of all, and you might have had something to do with this, the advertisement on your station. I've heard Scott Milne for many, many years on your program, and he came across very positive. He'd give news. He'd tell about the gas prices and how that affected flying and the cost of everything. And he just came across as an honest, a very sincere, likable person. And then when I met him about 2 months ago at a meeting, he came across as somebody who would listen to you. He hadn't had his mind made up on a lot of the issues, but he listened to what other people have telling him about the issues and then made up his mind. And last night, I was with him. He had a sign waving in front of City Hall in Barrie. Can you still hear me?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay, and he had that sign waving, and he was positive. He said, I'm going to win. He's willing to work hard, and he's honest. And you got a call while you were talking to the lady up in the Northeast Kingdom about how he was there on his own. And he was standing there at one point by himself, and I came and joined him, and his son came.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole bunch, his I don't know what you would call it, his personality.
Yeah, okay, well, let me thank you for your call, and let me turn this question to Eric Davis, and let me just sort of rephrase it a little bit. Was it Scott Milne's personality that really made the difference in the contrast? And could another candidate, a Randy Brock or a Heidi Sherman, have even taken that and gone further?
I that's an excellent question. I mean, as I was saying before, I think in many ways this election turned out to be a referendum on Peter Shumlin. Now, Randy Brock, you know, he would have run a more organized campaign than Scott Milne, certainly. He would have raised more money. He would have had policy positions from the get-go because he's familiar with that. Heidi Sherman would have been a newcomer. Be interesting to see how she would have done, you know, particularly in some of the more moderate and leaning parts of the state. You know, some of the Chittenden County suburbs, say, areas in the center part of the state. Again, she would have been more knowledgeable on policy issues, especially education, governance, and finance. But I think you know, Scott Milne as the sort of non-professional politician did have a certain appeal, and that can't be discounted. And you know, again, as I'll come back to the point I made a few minutes ago, what would have happened had Dan Feliciano not been a candidate this year?
What do you think?
I think Scott Milne would have finished narrowly ahead of Peter Shumlin, and then it would have been a very interesting choice with him. Heavily Democratic legislative vote for a Republican plurality winner.
And what would have happened if Chris Christie and the Republican National Committee had dumped some money into the state? Do you think that would have made a difference?
That could have made a difference. That could have made a difference. You know, again, Vermont is a small state, and you know the RGA and the DGA were often doing millions of dollars in the large states, but $200,000 or $300,000 in Vermont could have made a difference and would have represented about a doubling of what Scott Milne was able to raise on his own.
I mean, it's amazing, isn't it, how much money? I mean, you heard Peter Shumlin spent $980,000 or something. I mean, it's incredible to win by a point and a half.
To win by a point and a half. Well, that's less than he spent to win the office in the first place in 2010, with the combination of the five-way primary and the close race against Brian Doobie. He spent close to $1.5 million in 2010.
Right. But that was a lot more competitive race,
right.
or so we thought.
Right.
Let's go to Corinth Forbes. Good morning.
Hi. How are you?
All right.
Scott must have been listening to us when I said, give me some reason to vote for you. Last week.
Uh-huh.
But I have a real good question. We, the voters will, let's say, vote in a Democratic governor and then elect a Republican House and Senate. That fellow's got his back right against the wall all the way, and you know politically the reality of that. You never feather the opposition party's nest. So how do we ever get away from people voting for one party and then completely undermining or putting them against a wall so that nothing can get done? No support, no help.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Well, I'll talk about the difference between Vermont and Washington in that regard. I think even though the Republicans made some gains, Democrats are still going to have big majorities in the legislature. But I think the Democratic leadership is going to take some lessons from this. And I think one is that they have to do something about education and finance and governance over the next 2 years. And as I said, the Speaker, Shep Smith, has already set up a working party on this that includes some Republicans. And I think if there is will on the part of both party leaderships to work together and come up with a solution that can be presented to the voters of the state in 2 years, I think something can be done on that issue. In Washington, I'm less optimistic that anything on major issues will happen, whether it's immigration, tax reform, climate change, that I think what we may just see is gridlock over the next 2 years in Congress between a Republican Congress and a Democratic president, and both parties trying to gain advantage and begin the presidential campaign in 2016 immediately.
In addition to the governor, the person who really seemed to have taken a big hit last night, Dean Corin, the progressive Democrat, not even getting what Cassandra Geekus did.
I thought Corin could at least make it to 40%, if not into the low 40s, like 42 or so, but it looks like he's ending up at about 36%. First of all, he spent a lot of money. He had $200,000 in public financing. He had endorsements from a lot of high-profile Democrats and independents, and he doesn't seem to have got much support from other than the core Democratic base and progressive activists. To what extent this is a referendum on single-payer health care, it's hard to say. I think that is part of it. Phil Scott has incumbency advantages. People like him as an individual. He campaigned hard. He comes across as accessible. He had a lot of Democratic members of the Senate supporting him for re-election, so I think Dean Corin is the sort of biggest underperformer, and Phil Scott is the biggest overperformer in this election.
You know, that question of whether there is a connection between his, I mean, he went all in on single payer.
Oh, he did. He did. His advertising in the last couple of weeks emphasized it heavily, his mailings, his speeches. And again, I think that raises more questions about the future of single payer health care.
Mm-hmm. But what is it? Is it more about Phil Scott being incredibly popular or Dean Corin not being popular? Where is it?
I think it's a combination of the two. And, again, Scott is the incumbent and has the advantages there. And I think Corin just wasn't sort of able to break out of his own base.
Yeah. State Senate races, anything jump out at you?
Yeah. Republicans picked up two seats. I wasn't surprised by the Franklin County result. They picked up both seats there. Rutland County was a bit of a surprise. Brian Collamore, a newcomer, won the third seat there and defeated Bill Karras, who is a well-known name in Rutland.
Yeah.
I would say the two more surprising results for me were in Washington County and in Chittenden County. I thought Joy the Moj Republican was going to be competitive in Chittenden and it might make a good run for that seat, but she ended up being a distant eighth. And in Washington County, in the end, Ann Cummings, Anthony Polina, and Bill Doyle ended up taking advantage of their various incumbent resources. They don't necessarily overlap, but the three of them managed to win, and Pat McDonald, who ran a hard campaign and a well-fought campaign, finished in a narrow fourth.
Mm-hmm. All right, so gaining two seats you think is actually a big deal?
I think gaining two seats is a big deal because it sets the Republicans in the right direction. I think gaining what it looks like 8 to 10 in the House is a bigger deal because the Democrats will no longer have the so-called supermajority in the House. Not that that matters while Shumlin is governor, but it will give the Republicans more voice on the committees and in the floor and things like that. Again, another lesson I think that David Sunderland, the party chair, and Don Turner, the House minority leader, may take away from this is if they had been able to recruit Republican candidates in more districts, might they have won even more seats? They only ran candidates in about 90 of the 150 seats. If they had come up with 100 or 110 candidates, might they have won maybe three or four more seats?
What do you think the long-term effect of the Milne almost victory is on that?
I think, again, if Turner and Sunderland get to work early on recruiting legislative candidates for 2016, I think they can build and pick up a few more seats. So I also found interesting, Mark, that some of the places where Republican candidates won, there was a high-profile Democrat who lost, Mike Fisher of Bristol, who's the chair of the House Health Care Committee. He was defeated and was probably the highest-profile Democrat to lose in the House. The Republicans picked up the open seat in the Chittenden suburbs that Martha Heath, who used to be chair of the House Appropriations Committee, held. She retired, and the Republicans picked up that seat. The Republicans picked up a seat in Essex. They won a few seats in parts of the state that have not necessarily been traditionally Republican, as well as picking up some in the Northeast Kingdom, both St. Johnsbury seats, for example, picking up some Franklin County seats and then Rutland County.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel at all uncomfortable with the prediction you made last week?
About the governor's race?
Yeah.
I didn't anticipate the extent of dissatisfaction with Peter Shumlin. I think that's the way I would put it. I thought he would, as I say, 48 was his floor for me, and it looks like he's 1 to 2 points below that.
Yeah, I guess that's how I would describe it, too. The depth of the dissatisfaction is the phrase I'm hanging on to. It's really out there. There's no question about it. I guess I'm wondering... Yeah. You know, how we miss that. That's what I'm wondering.
Well, and you know, again, you know, I've done a lot of talks around the state to various groups this fall in the election. And one of the things in the Q&A afterward that people often bring up spontaneously is that land deal in East Montpelier.
Yep.
It's now almost a year and a half ago. But I think in many ways the news coverage of that set the tone for the way a lot of people feel about Peter Shumlin. And even though that incident was barely mentioned during the campaign, I think the sense that voters have that Shumlin may be too clever by half and you can't always trust him, I think that's very much out there.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. I think, you know, some were dismissing the Jeremy Dodge story as being at all relevant in this campaign. And, you know, for a lot of people, it raised a fundamental character issue. And for some people, that's as far as they go.
Exactly. And, I mean, again, I'd compare Peter Shumlin in that regard with people like Pat Leahy or Bernie Sanders or Jim Douglas, who've had very strong levels of personal support, even from people who don't necessarily agree with them on issues.
And getting back to Bill's call, that contrast that Scott Milne provided may have really accentuated that problem with the land deal.
That may have, yes.
Any other observations you want to share with us before we let you go?
No, I think the U.S. Senate turned out about as I expected. The one surprise there was the Republicans winning the North Carolina seat. The others went pretty much as I thought. I think the Democrats contain a little credit from the results in New Hampshire. Gene Shaheen, the Democratic senator, won re-election. Maggie Hassan, the Democratic governor, won re-election comfortably, and the Democrats held on to one of the two competitive House seats in New Hampshire.
Thank you, as always, for your time. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Mark.
Eric Davis, retired political science professor from Middlebury College, longtime guest here on the program. I know there were a bunch of you that wanted to talk to him as well. His time this morning was limited, but you can we can chat after we take a break here. Love to hear your thoughts, comments. You can call us at 244-1777, toll-free 877-291-8255. We'll be back right after this.
$3,000. That's the minimum your trade is worth during Cash for Junkers. No matter what it is or how little you might think it's worth. Hi, this is Steve Sace from the new McMahon Chevy Buick in Mooresville.
And I'm Ed Dever, sales manager at McMahon. During Cash for Junkers, if your trade rolls, floats, or flies and has a VIN number, you get a guarantee.